In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
And welcome. This is the I Spy Radio Show. Glad you're joining us today. As every week, we help you get a little more intelligence on big government. Before we get going, I wanted to comment on Jeff Sessions coming under fire on Thursday, the day after the story broke that the Obama administration had created a $3 billion slush fund through the Department of Justice, the very department that Jeff Sessions is now the head of. You don't think those two are related? Obama and the left know that Soros and his co-conspirators can't donate $3 billion per year. They would run out of money. The left has to have that money coming in. That's just one department. What do you think will be uncovered when Trump's budget hawks start going through line by line through the budgets of the EPA, the Department of Energy, the Department of Education, Department of Health and Human Services? We already know Obama's White House gave $22.2 billion in fiscal year 2014 alone. Every penny of that $22.2 billion went to fund leftist organizations and their ideology. The left uses the federal taxpayer as their slush fund, and Trump knows it, and the left knows that Trump knows it. And that's why they are doing everything possible to undermine him. His administration is a threat to their entire operation. Government does not create jobs. We've said this before here on iSpy. Government does not create jobs, they create liabilities. Because to keep a government job, year after year, taxes must be raised every year to keep paying for that job. The government does not create products that people pay for. That's the fallacy of leftist thinking. It's like hiring people to work in a factory that produces nothing. Cash goes in, but nothing comes out. The assembly line rolling by all of those high-paid government workers, including getting their health care and everything else, that assembly line is completely empty. How long would a company like that stay in business? It wouldn't. But to keep those workers there year after year, they have to force taxpayers to pay for all of those liabilities. And that's what funds the left. Stop that money flowing to them, like that $3 billion slush fund and that $22.2 billion slush fund, and their entire factory will be forced to shut down. Now, on to today's show, we're talking about two hot-button issues, immigration and trade. These issues are continuing to roll out under the Trump administration, and we are just starting to see the beginnings of these, so we want to help you get a leg up on what's going to be happening. First up, we'll talk with William Gein of Alipac, and then a new guest, Michael Stumo, the CEO of Coalition for a Prosperous America, to talk about our trade agreements. I'd like to welcome now William Gein. He is president and spokesman of Alipac. That's Americans for Legal Immigration Political Action Committee. Their website is Alipac, A-L-I-P-A-C.org, if you'd like to go visit them. William, it's always good to talk to you.
Thank you.
Well, immigration, of course, continues to be an ongoing issue and very prominent in the news. And first off, President Trump made it very clear in his joint congressional speech Tuesday night that he is intending on keeping his campaign promises regarding immigration. A lot of people were hoping that suddenly he would not. So let's go down the checklist of some of those and just get your thoughts on that. Once again, he reiterated that he is going to build a border wall and that Mexico will pay for it. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I would disagree with you a little bit on the making it very clear that he was going to keep all of his campaign promises. One of his very important campaign promises he has not kept was to end Obama's clearly unconstitutional, illegal amnesty memo orders called DACA. And from what we understand, he is continuing DACA and DAPA, which means illegal immigrants are receiving this form of amnesty under Trump's administration, which makes them Trump's orders, not Obama's. So at this point, we have a type of Trump amnesty order in effect that we are encouraging people to contact the White House and ask for that to be removed. Also, during a speech, he said something very vague about immigration reform that has eluded us for a while. Well, he didn't use the words immigration reform when he was campaigning, and immigration reform in Washington, D.C. has become synonymous with amnesty for illegal immigrants. Every single bill that's come up over the last two decades that was called immigration reform contained a form of amnesty for illegal immigrants. And the big scare that happened with his speech the other day was CNN, who of course we don't trust, The Hill, and even Fox News and several other news agencies all came running out of the dinner, the lunch they had with Trump, claiming that he had said he was ready to compromise on immigration and something like that, something amnesty sounded, something about letting illegal non-criminal or non-broader criminality illegal immigrants stay in the United States, and that they thought he was going to say that in his speech. It did not manifest in his speech. But we've got a lot of mixed messages, a lot of mixed signals coming out of the Trump administration right now, and we still don't know what he's going to do, because you see the wall, building the wall, even if he sent the military to the border, which he should do, because that's how far out of control the border is, and the drug gangs are practically military in their level of sophistication and weaponry and manpower, but. Even if he did all this stuff on the border, none of that's going to last. None of that's going to save America if the current stock of 10 to 20 million illegal immigrants are allowed here to stay, because they will eventually become Democrat socialist voters, turn all states and all branches of government blue. And a lot of people don't want to hear that right now, because we've got a situation where, you know, so many states just went red, and with the Republicans have the presidency, and they have the Congress and the, you know, Supreme Court soon, and you know, all of these things, it's like red, red, red. They don't understand the long-term demographic shift in mathematics of what happens if you let these illegals stay. And it all turns blue permanently. That's why the Democrats know they can just wait it out. They can say unpopular things. They can do unpopular things. They can beat people in the streets. But if they wait long enough and those illegals continue to vote illegally or ever get legalized, there's a ruse being circulated that they can be given legal status. And that won't be amnesty. They'll never get to vote, you'll be told. Look, high school, Congress may not create a second class of citizenship. If illegal immigrants are ever, the law is ever changed to accommodate them, they will eventually vote. It'll only take an activist judge or two. Boom, boom. Republicans will throw their hands up and say, oh, we didn't mean for that to happen. It won't matter. You'll never get another Donald Trump. You'll never get another truly conservative American, and because you will have 10 to 20 million additional straight Democrat Party voting prior illegal aliens that you won't be able to do anything about in elections anymore.
Yeah, well, in terms of the newspaper editors, I don't know how much I trust that, but it would not surprise me if what Trump did in that meeting is he may have mentioned something akin to that. And let them go out there and talk about that, and then doesn't respond to anything like that in his speech. And to me, that's actually intelligent thinking on his part, because what it's really doing is it undermines the credibility of the press once again. Let's go ahead and take a break right there. Coming up, we'll continue those thoughts after the break. Stay with us. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. I'm your host, Mark Anderson, talking today to William Gein of ALIPAC. That's Americans for Legal Immigration. And you can find them at ALIPAC.org. And, of course, we'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com as well. And so going into the break there, we're talking about the comments there of, that Trump allegedly made to some of these newspaper editors and whatnot. And also we were talking about DACA. And in terms of that, I am suspicious that he is just waiting to roll that back on some level, because you know that was a huge campaign promise on his part, and I don't see him going back on that. And so, what are your thoughts in terms of, is this something that we will see down the road, or are you thinking that he's abandoning that?
Well, I think that all it takes for him to do is a stroke of the pen. It's not even an executive order that Obama issued; it was memos, and he said it was unconstitutional. He said he would do it on day one. It's like day 40. He needs to realize, too, that if he breaks any of his immigration campaign promises, then all promises become suspect. He promised us over and over again he wouldn't let us down, that he would keep his promises. And so DACA stands in that. The other thing that I think is a very big danger here is you've got a lot of people that are tired of fighting, tired of the craziness. They've been involved with the contentious elections of 2016. Now the Democrats are continuing to freak out, and the news comes in every day of more crazy political stuff. A lot of people are just tired of it. And a lot of people are also excited that Trump won and beat Hillary and overconfident. Right now, I think one of the biggest dangers is a lot of people think that because Donald Trump promised to do these things and because he is now the president, that there is no need for them to donate or volunteer or take broader civic action at this time. Mm-hmm. And that is one of the most dangerous things we face.
Oh, yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I have always felt that when it comes to holding politicians accountable, you need to hold your own side more accountable than you do the other side. And I absolutely agree with you. This is not the time to step back your activism. It's not the time to start pulling in your reins on things. Yeah, absolutely. Donations need to keep going. People's activism needs to keep going. You cannot let this rest for sure.
Well, I can tell you right now, after just passing the deadline for Alipac's first funds drive of 2017 last night at midnight, we know that there's a substantial portion of people that are amongst the anti-illegal immigration, immigration reduction movement that have stood down. And it's not a huge chunk, but maybe 10 or 15, maybe 10 to 20% did not respond. And that's enough to possibly sink us right now, where there's only four national organizations fighting illegal immigration, of which ours, Americans for Legal Immigration PAC, is the only political action committee that can directly endorse candidates, oppose candidates, do things in elections, and have maximum free speech stuff. The other groups are great groups. They do different things, but they don't have the latitude that we have with what we say. We can say anything because we're a PAC. Everything we say is perfectly protected under campaign free speech. If you're a 501c3 nonprofit, well, your donors
can't
do get
it.
The benefit.
Yeah.
Yeah, they get the benefit of the tax donation, but you can't. You have to be very careful what you say about legislation and candidates and campaigns and elections, because there's heavy restrictions on what you can even say or do there. But I can tell you right now, we've got direct evidence that there are people out there that are resting on laurels or are making a false assumption that everything's going to be okay. You know, America's fate has a chance now. It just has a chance because we stopped Hillary Clinton. Doesn't mean it's going to happen. Doesn't mean that somebody else is going to do it. And we've got to find a way to keep people engaged with these politicians, campaigns, elections, and issues so that the actual changes. It's not enough just to change which party is resting their heels up at the White House. We've done that in the Congress. We've had that in the Supreme Court. Has it changed the policies in the direction for the country? No. It won't happen unless the people make it happen. It's not Donald Trump that makes it happen. It's the people.
That's right. Well, in terms of your donations and the drop-off there, how does that compare with other election years? Is there always a drop-off in that first quarter, or is this a little more significant?
Yeah, this is much more significant. We've had we're down about $8,000, and we don't even know how we're going to fill the hole. That's what we're going to be spending our weekend doing, is figuring out how to fill a hole. We don't have the money for. One of the things, we've always been a very shoestring, low-budget operation that has been capable of big things because a lot of times our messages and our strategies have been very innovative. We've been willing to rush into burning buildings first. A lot of times we've been able to throw Hail Mary passes that connected because we were, you know, crazy like a fox and willing to do it. We've been very nimble about it, and we've been able to, you know, push back some Goliaths, but you can't run on nothing or fumes. I mean, at the end of the day, there's mathematics involved with national organizations and websites and limited salaries and other stuff that have to be met. You know, if I was an independently wealthy person, I would just do this all day and night and not have to raise anything from anyone. I'd love it if that was the case. But no, I'm just not a person that's in a position that can do that. And I've spent 12 years of my life doing this. I have no retirement savings. I have no health care, nothing. And I've had to face down some pretty scary people, because when you stand up against the people responsible for this illegal alien invasion and overthrow of our nation, they're very serious-minded, well-funded, very dangerous people that, you know, at the minimum will say and do a lot of bad things to you. So it's been a real tough time. I'm very glad that Donald Trump won. I wanted to help Donald Trump keep his promises. But at the same time, I want to be one of the first people to stand up when he doesn't keep a promise and make it very clear. If we all send a signal to Donald Trump, it's like, that's okay, we'll give you some slack on this, and we'll give you some slack on that. What you're going to end up with is a bunch of slack. You're going to end up in a situation where the man and the people around him think, well, we said this and we said that, and we can do this and we can do that, and there's no consequence. We don't lose anybody. Nobody says anything, blah, 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 you know. You're right back to business as usual in Washington, D.C., and we saw that with the Tea Party movement. I'm not going to mention any particular organizations and groups, but look what happened to the Tea Party. Rose up, got real active in 2008, 2010. My organization, Alipac, led a coalition of 27 different anti-illegal immigration groups behind the first Tea Party wave. We helped make it the success that it was, and 2 years later, they're all marching up to Washington, D.C. with Glenn Beck leading the parade. And when they get there, all our 27 organizations had not been invited to participate, and you had illegal immigrants at podiums talking about immigration reform, amnesty for illegals.
Yeah.
They marched the Tea Party right into Washington, D.C. The D.C. Alligators found people within the Tea Party movement that liked to wine and dine, and they flew them up there and had them in expensive hotels and rubbed their shoulders and told them how special they were. And at the end of the day, nothing happened.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, the Tea Party had no impact on stopping Obamacare, reducing taxes, stopping the debt ceiling, stopping the bailouts, no impact.
Yeah, and that ties in nicely to what I said in my opener there, where the left absolutely knows that they have to have that funding going, because in order to get any of these political movements and have a sustained effort, you have to have funds, and that's why they're so desperate to keep the money spigot open from the U.S. taxpayer. All right, let's go ahead and take a break there. Coming back, we're going to be talking about some jobs. Stay with us.
Stay informed. News, information, and all our past shows are available on iSpyRadio.com.
And welcome back. We're talking today to William Gein. He is the president and spokesman of ALIPAC. That's Americans for Legal Immigration Political Action Committee, ALIPAC.org, if you'd like to go visit them. And we were talking during the break there about that slush fund suddenly being cut off from the Department of Justice. And you raised a really great point, is that, you know, it really is depriving the other side from so much of their funding. I mean, that is a huge win for you. Even if you're not getting any more funding, at least they're being cut off.
Yeah, well, if we can get it cut off, I mean, has it been done yet? All I've seen is the headline saying lawmakers are going to try to do it. And you know, you've got to, when you deal with the deep state, when you deal with the bureaucracies and how things work in there, they have a way of surviving.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's something that I haven't read into in detail yet today, but I am hopeful that that can be turned off, because these La Raza groups and these social justice warrior groups have just been so terrible and antagonistic. And I'll be honest with you, I mean, other than billionaire people want to overthrow the United States into a form of socialism like George Soros and Mark Zuckerberg and nation states like China and Saudi Arabia, the American public really won't want to fund these groups.
Yeah.
These groups could not exist unless they had the big power players or the U.S. taxpayer money that they've been come to depend on.
Yes, that's exactly right. And the way that it works is very similar to what happens within the environmental system. And what happens is you have these groups that do the sue and settle, but also this particular one, the way that it worked was the banks were being sued by the Department of Justice. And so as part of the settlement, DOJ was insisting that they donate money to La Raza and some of these other organizations, and it's kind of a penance in a way for doing something that they were being accused of. And so it was a payoff. So it never actually went through the taxpayer dollars. I think it was a direct payment, but in some cases it did go to the taxpayers, but then it was just refunded Department of Justice, and then refunded off to La Raza and whatnot. But anyway, it's been going on since the 90s. Bill Clinton is really the one that first started all of that. And of course, they made it hard to track when they removed the Paperwork Reduction Act. When they put that into place, it removed the ability to track those fundings. Anyway, so earlier this week, President...
Real quick note on that. In the Department of Justice, Jeff Sessions needs our support. Jeff Sessions is one of the best we have in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
And a lot of Republicans are jumping on him now, too, saying, oh, he's been talking to Russia. And when you look at the names of those Republicans, like Representative Kevin McCarthy and other, and what's his name from Utah, Jason Chauvet, it's the amnesty Republicans. It's the immigration reform, amnesty, illegal alien supporting Republicans that are going after Jeff Sessions and the Justice Department. And folks need to realize how powerful that can be, because it only takes 5 or 10, maybe 20 House Republicans to vote with all the Democrats, and they run the show. The Democrats can run the show with this group of sellout Republicans. It's just a narrow band of them voting with them, and they're aligned on immigration. They're aligned against real immigration enforcement, like what Jeff Sessions would like to do.
Yeah, not a big surprise that the bad actors in the past continue to be the ones here with going after Jeff Sessions. John McCain's another one, and for heaven's sakes, he not only met with Russians, he's met with ISIS and Al-Qaeda and actually helped fund them. So it's ridiculous that he has anything to say about Jeff Sessions. Anyway, earlier this week, President Trump had said that he wanted to modernize immigration law by making it merit-based. Are you familiar with that, and can you describe to us what that means?
Well, I mean, we all want people that come here legally to be here, you know, because they have the type of qualities that we want to have in our country. But at the same time, I'm a little cautious about merit-based language because the Gang of Eight amnesty bill contained that type of suggestions and stuff in it. And to be honest with you, Paul Ryan was smiling far too much, and Mike Pence, when Trump mentioned immigration issues in the speech the other night. Paul Ryan supports full-blown amnesty for a form of he will deny it. But when you look at what type of legislation he's been forwarding, what type of legislation he's been proposing, he supports amnesty for illegal immigrants, and he's all happy about Trump right now. Also, if Trump was really going to crack down on illegal immigration and get a lot of them out of here like he promised and not support amnesty like he promised, the stock market I would expect to be a little bit more hesitant because there would be some economic shocks along with removing the illegal immigrants. Some of the housing markets and the consumer markets, Walmart, you know, your McDonald's, places like that, they would take some hit to some degree by us removing several million or pushing several million illegal immigrants out of the country. Stock market doesn't seem to have a concern about that right now. So there are a lot of red flags and warning signs popping up, and that's why we want people to stay engaged. We wish it was like clear-cut, black and white, simple A or B, one or two, you know, Democrat or Republican, flip a switch this or way, how simple it is. But the invasion and overthrow of this country is not a simple matter, and the people that have been conducting it before most people even knew there was a major problem or how organized it was, it's been happening by stealth through elaborate and extremely deceptive means. And Trump's hired some of those people. Rince Priebus, his new labor secretary pick, is horrible. We've got a whole section at alipac.us on this guy. He's got a whole background supporting amnesty for illegal immigrants. And, you know, we're talking about Alexander Acosta being put into the labor secretary position, which helps oversee immigration enforcement raids on employers that hire illegal immigrants. We've got a pro-amnesty, Alexander Acosta is a pro-amnesty pick by Trump for labor. And so there's a lot of red flags and concerns that really suggest that people need to pay attention, stay involved.
Yeah, well, definitely. That gets back to our earlier point, too, about just not letting up once your guy gets in office and you need to really hold their feet to the fire. Just real quick, the Canadians, a lot of this merit base seems to have been based on some of Canada's immigration system, where people are admitted because they will add to the economy in some way rather than simply through family ties, which is what is happening here. About 63% of those granted legal permanent residents in Canada get there because they are being admitted for their economic skills, and that's very different from what we have here.
I would say if the socialists of Canada like it, then there's another reason to be worried about it.
Well, I would at least rather that they're admitted because they've got some job skills versus they are coming here because their parents, grandparents, grandkids, cousins, and so on and so forth are all here. And they're all on the public dole, so I'd rather they're at least contributing in some way.
Well, at the end of the day, what's a year from now? Okay, 1 year from now, at the end of the year, what's going to matter is, are there less illegal immigrants in the United States than there are now? And not because they were made legal, okay? The people that are the current stock of illegal immigrants right now, are there a lot less of them in this country 1 year from now, yes or no? 1 year from now, have legal immigration levels that have been running at an unsustainable hyper level for last 15 years or more, have they been reduced? Are there less legal immigrants being admitted to the United States 1 year from now? Are there less current illegal aliens?
I do know that I saw on Drudge Report that the immigration border crossings, the illegal ones, have been reduced already by about 27%. So, unfortunately, we're up against a break here. Wayne Gein, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. I'm your host, Mark Anderson, talking today to Michael Stumo. He is the CEO of Coalition for Prosperous America. That is a coalition of agriculture, manufacturing, and organized labor associations, companies, and individuals. Michael, it's good to talk to you.
It's great to be here, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so you are a new-to-us organization, so why don't you tell us a little bit about your group and what do you focus on?
We're a national bipartisan organization with farmers, ranchers, manufacturers, and organized labor. We have lefties and righties and everything in between. It's sort of an ideological Star Wars bar scene. But It's the trade issue, the trade and jobs issue and economic growth that we focus on, balancing trade, getting rid of the U.S. trade deficit so we produce more of what we consume, and that does not tend to be a partisan issue. And it'll unite people anywhere from Trumpers to, you know, the burners, the Bernie folks, and everything in between. So it's a hot issue these days.
Yes, and it was certainly one of the big issues that Trump really made a central part of his campaign, getting rid of some of these trade deals, and that's really what we wanted to focus on with you is we kind of know what a bad trade deal looks like, but it's sometimes hard for people to envision what a good trade deal looks like. And as you say, we have a huge trade deficit right now with a lot of our trading partners. And in fact, I can't even think of one offhand that we don't have a deficit on some levels with. In terms of the coalition itself, are you a 501c3, C4, PAC? What are you guys?
Yeah, so we have two sister entities. One is a 501c3 to educate, you know, the general public and the media on, you know, trade's connection with jobs and economic growth and, you know, U.S. industry success. And we have a C4 that does more issue advocacy on the Hill.
Ah. Well, you guys are really, as you said, you're sort of focusing on the forgotten voters in the last election. These are the blue-collar workers and farms, factories, mines, and forests. And Trump, of course, was trying to say that under the under his administration, trade would flourish. And however, for free trade to bring prosperity to America, must also be fair trade. And it sounds like that's really what you guys are focusing on as well.
Yeah. Yes, that's true. I mean, think about it. You know, the volume of trade in the world going any direction you please, in or out of any particular country, the aggregate volume of trade typically tracks the economic growth of countries in the world. But the problem with the trade agreements is that so often with the U.S. we end up importing more than we export. We get promised all these export and export opportunities, and they don't materialize to the extent that we give up domestic market share with a raft of imports. And so just like a business contract, you have a business contract. If you end up, you know, buying from your business partner more than you sell, you're in the negative. You might want to change it.
Right. So in terms of wielding some influence then, are you guys advising the Trump administration? Are you working with Congress? How do you guys promote what it is that you're trying to promote?
Sure. Well, we have on our board, for example, we have members across the country, and we're at prosperousamerica.org. On our board, we have members that were part of the Trump campaign. In fact, one of our board members was a head of the Trump trade transition team. We had other members who were very close with the Clinton campaign, including AFL-CIO representatives and some other from the Democratic side. So it was pretty interesting board meetings in the months leading up to the election, that's for sure.
Yes, I can imagine.
So we have, of course, Trump largely won because he was relentless on the trade and job loss issue, and that won him, you know, most of the geography of the country between the big cities. And, you know, the Democrats are going to have to figure out what their message is. And the Democrats in our organization are trying to get them to get on that message, even as the Trump supporters are really happy that we have some opportunity to make some positive change in trade.
Right. Well, you guys have a great infographic up on your site, and just to mention that again, it's prosperousamerica.org. And if people go to the Who We Are section there, on your infographic, it says, under our purpose, it says, if burdens are reduced, such as taxes lowered, EPA rules relaxed, employment benefit costs lowered, and those are all things that I think Trump would have supported, certainly Trump supporters would agree with. But you say this, your business will still fail if you have lost your customers because of unfair trade cheating. And I think that would probably surprise people. They assume that if you remove these regulatory burdens, that somehow that paves the path to success, but there's still more to be done there.
Yes, there is. You know, if you lower taxes or you know, reduce regulation for all their merits, and I'm not suggesting that, you know, there's anything wrong with that at all, you're talking about a couple percentage points off your costs, usually, unless you're in a, you know, you know, coal or something, you know, where it really falls hard on you. But you're talking about a couple percentage points. But when China devalues its currency by 40%, it makes that results in making our exports to them 40% more expensive and their imports to us economy-wide 40% cheaper. It's an economy-wide fire sale. There's virtually nothing we can do domestically to offset that. And so you've got, you know, that's essentially a trade cheating mechanism, currency devaluation and some other things. Border taxes at 17%. These are very big numbers. If you balance trade, we had a $500 billion deficit last year. If you get that back into balance where we sell about as much as we buy, which is actually the natural result of free trade, what it's supposed to be, that's about 4 million jobs. There's nothing on the agenda in Washington that touches a four million job number.
No, absolutely not. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. Coming up, we'll be talking more about trade deals, what they are, and what a good one would look like. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking about trade today with Michael Stumo. He is the CEO of Coalition for a Prosperous America. You can find their website at prosperousamerica.org. And they are a coalition of agriculture, manufacturing, and organized labor associations, companies, and individuals. So we kind of have an idea of what a bad trade deal would look like. And the TPP being a perfect example of that. We've covered that a number of times here on iSpy Radio. But it's often hard for people to visualize what a good trade deal would look like. And you guys have a fantastic resource up there on your website. It's called 21st Century Trade Agreement Principles. And this is available either online or you can download it as a PDF, which I find to be very handy because then I can make a bunch of notes on it. And I thought we would just sort of walk through some of these principles. The first one that well let's actually start a little bit, kind of give an encapsulation view. So a lot of people, I think, get intimidated by the notion of these big trade deals, and they somehow seem kind of sacrosanct, where they shouldn't be touched. But really, when it comes right down to it, a trade agreement is a simple business deal, is it not?
Yes, it's a business contract between countries, and it's important to note that we do trade with countries without trade agreements, and we traded with countries before trade agreements existed. And trade flows track economic size of nations in the world back before they existed. Mm. So the existence or not of a trade agreement doesn't mean the existence or not of trade. It's just how are you managing it between countries.
I see. And, you know, if we have traded with countries in the past without these trade deals, what's the point of then putting together a trade agreement?
Well, there's... you know, there's certain things countries do that the first thing is they want their mechanisms to get rid of tariffs and quotas. That's what it really sort of started with. And there's a view in the classic trade, you know, establishment group that all tariffs are bad no matter what, and that if we get rid of them, there will be free trade. The problem we've seen is there's so many ways to replace those tariffs and tilt the scales in your favor that they haven't addressed. And, you know, quite frankly, sometimes tariffs are a good policy tool. I'm not saying all the time, but mostly trade agreements were just a way to get rid of tariffs and quotas in the world. Mm.
Well, and I think a lot of that stems from some classical education, certainly with Frederick Bastiat, who talked about the candle makers. They're petitioning the king for protectionism because the sun had an unfair competitive advantage there, and so they were trying to look for protection. And I think you're right. I think a lot of people look at tariffs as bad, certainly on the conservative side. They see tariffs as bad, and free trade is kind of being the ultimate goal that we should all be aspiring to whenever it comes to these trade deals. But at the same time, you really do have to have fair trade, I think, because – you know, it's great if you're not having any tariffs, but if your other side either has tariffs imposed or have what amounts to the effect of a tariff, you know, and you mentioned that in the last segment there about currency manipulation and whatnot, it's no longer free trade nor fair trade.
Right. You know, countries can replace their tariffs with other mechanisms and tilt the playing field. And there's about 10 countries that are really the culprits in the world. About 10 countries make up about 90% of our trade deficit. So there's special cases we need to, you know, take a look at, you know, how to fix our trade balance with those countries. And indeed, free trade was the antidote to medieval mercantilism, sort of the medieval crony capitalism, where the king tried to tilt everything in his favor, have a net persistent net exports to collect gold to fund the building of palaces and do empire building. And it's perfectly legitimate to get rid of that. But now these days we have sort of a new mercantilism, a new trade cheating that the system hasn't addressed. And we're, you know, the rest of the big surplus countries like China and Japan and Germany are relying on the U.S. consumer market to grow excessively. And that's causing unemployment and wage stagnation here.
Yes. And so let's go ahead and look at some of these 21st century trade agreement principles. And you say here very clearly, trade agreements are business contracts between countries. They involve rights and obligations, concessions and benefits, performance and breach. The United States has stated that it will negotiate 21st century trade agreements, which presumably will improve upon those of the 20th century. So the first principle that you have here is balanced trade. And trade agreements must contribute to a national goal of achieving a manageable balance of trade over time. So why don't you comment a little bit on that?
Sure, yeah. Free trade is supposed to get to balance. In other words, countries don't have persistent trade deficits where they import far more than they export. Because when you import far more than you export, like last year for us, $500 billion, that amount of money went out of the country. That amount of sort of, you know, demand of our consumer demand leaked to offshore producers on net. If you balance it, get rid of the trade deficit, that is really what the free trade is supposed to produce, is sort of a shifting balance over time. So no one country is in deficit all the time and no one country is in surplus all the time. We haven't achieved that. And it's never been an explicit goal. Only tariff reduction has been a goal. So we thought, you know, quantitative balance, let's make that a goal because that's what free trade is supposed to achieve. And it's not.
Well, did we used to have that?
Yeah, there was yes and no. now we're getting into a PhD class here, but, free-floating currency is supposed to adjust. So if you're a deficit country, your currency is supposed to devalue naturally to make your goods cheaper so that you sell more of your cheaper goods, put people back to work and come into balance. If you're a big surplus country like Germany, your currency should appreciate or go up, making your goods more expensive to foreigners. So you sell less and you cool down the economy and you get back to balance. Mm-hmm. So it's supposed to be a self-regulating system. When we were pegged to gold, that was an issue because the currency couldn't adjust because it was pegged. It wasn't adjusting to economic strength or weakness. But now we're in a free-floating currency world, not pegged to gold, and I'm not commenting for or against gold or anything else. But now we find that it actually doesn't do that, and countries actually manipulate their currency values for a trade advantage.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that's the theory, yeah.
Okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. Come back, we'll continue our discussion here with Michael and be looking some more at their 21st Century Trade Agreement principles. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're in our final segment now with Michael Stumo. He is the CEO of Coalition for a Prosperous America. Their website is prosperousamerica.org if you'd like to go visit them. And so we're talking about the principles for 21st century trade agreements, and we're not going to get through all of these, unfortunately. We're just barely scratching now into number two, which is national trade, economic, and security strategy. Trade agreements must strive to optimize value-added supply chains within the U.S., from raw material to finished product, pursuant to a national trade and economic strategy that creates jobs, wealth, and sustained growth. And I can almost hear our audience saying, you mean to tell me that our trade agreements are not promoting that?
Yeah, well, you know, free trade is supposed to, you know, under the theory that has failed in this circumstance, when other countries do have a strategy and we don't, our leaders just say, well, if we just get to free trade, don't have any other strategy, the economy will sort it out. That's an attractive an attractive concept, then we won't be sowing duffel bags and growing turnips. We'll go to high value added things that, you know, build wealth in our country. But when we don't have a strategy and others do, like China, Japan, Germany, they do, and they do use trade to focus on, you know, the type of jobs and wealth and, you know, advanced technology and manufacturing, supply chains and the like. And we're losing them. In fact, in advanced manufacturing and high tech, we've had a trade deficit for many since 2002, when their theory said that that's where we should be excelling. And it's because we don't have a strategy. And then, of course, we don't have duffel bag sewing or turnip growing doing well either. So then we get wage stagnation and underemployment.
Well, I think a good example of all of this is lumber, which is, of course, very important here in the Pacific Northwest. We have huge quantities of lumber here. I mean, you can't stop the stuff from growing, and yet we have been handcuffed by federal regulations preventing us from cutting that lumber. But instead, what happens, we end up importing lumber from Canada, China, Southeast Asia, and other areas of the world, not necessarily because it's less expensive, but because of our own restrictive regulations. And I think that gets into what you're saying there, is that the U.S. has to pursue trade policies that produces more of what the nation consumes. And clearly, we need lumber.
Right. And actually, Sweden, I was in Norway and Sweden last summer. Sweden has a lot of lumber, you may or may not know, but they treat it as their high-tech product. And they put a lot of R&D into it and, you know, make a big, you know, successful supply chain and export industry out of it. Canada subsidizes it. Other countries use clear-cutting practices to undercut us. They have to really work to undercut us in order to justify not only cutting it the shipping cost. To ship it this far and undercut us usually takes some subsidization and strategy. It doesn't just happen in the natural world.
That's right. Yeah. And so that you've got the government subsidizing those industries, much as, you know, we have done here with solar and wind, and it really creates a false price perception within the market. We've only got a couple minutes here with you, so we'll have to set aside the principles and let people take a look at those online. I did want to ask you, what about China? What do you make about the fact that now they are saying, and I think this ties into the whole strategy aspect, now they're saying they don't want to just produce anymore, but they actually want to be part of the research and development and that end of the scale.
Right. Larry Summers and the elite economists of, you know, the past decades have said, well, let's let manufacturing go somewhere else. We don't care about that. We'll do the R&D, we'll do the design and have a service industry. Number one, that doesn't work because, number one, there's a lot of jobs in manufacturing. You have 1,000 jobs in manufacturing and 10 jobs in design and another 10 in the engineering section. So what are those folks going to do? 66% of our workforce has no four-year degree. You got to have something for them to do. Secondly, design and engineering follows manufacturing as well as innovation. You don't separate them. Third, if you only do services, once you take manufacturing, which is a high wage sector, out, those people lose their jobs, and it also lowers wages for the rest of the community, including the service industry. We can explain why, but that's an actual fact. And the service industry tends to be more of your underemployment sector, with not only, you know, contract workers, part-time workers, low-wage workers in the form of nurses' aides and burger flippers and the like, because we can't all be lawyers, doctors, and finance brokers.
Mm. Well, absolutely.
So we lower the quality of our the overall jobs in our economy by doing that. It didn't work.
Absolutely. All right. Well, Michael, I want to thank you so much for your time, and we'll definitely have to have you back to talk some more about trade issues.
My pleasure.
All right. Take care. That is all of our time for today. Thank you for joining us. We certainly hope that you're at least a little wiser than when you got here. Just a reminder for our listeners in Grants Pass in the Medford area, Burgess Owens, a former NFL star, conservative author, Fox News contributor, and iSpy radio show guest, will be the keynote speaker at the Jackson County Republican Day Dinner, March 18th at the Rogue Valley Country Club in Medford. For more details, head to iSpyRadio.com and click on the events tab at the top. While you're there, check out today's show page for links to today's guests and a whole lot more. Share those with your friends, families, and even your enemies, because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a faith
that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.